how is this tour conceived?
Well, Kit, in the early 1944, the Navy and the Army both sent their athletic specialists over to the Pearl Harbor area to set up athletic programs, and basically baseball programs, to entertain and set up leagues on these bases. And what the Army did was send all their players to one particular base, which was the 7th Air Force at Hickam Field. And they had an outstanding team that was, they had DiMaggio and Joe DiMaggio, and they had Joe Gordon. They almost had a complete major league team. Well, the Navy did differently. They sent two or three people to different bases in that area, and as a result, they're overmatched. So finally, at the end of the 44 season, while the Navy got tired of being swamped by the Army, so they brought in players from all over the globe. They brought in Vandermeer, Johnny Vandermeer, and Virgil Trucks from Great Lakes, and Schoolboy Rowe, and Billy Herman. And the people who were already over there, they flew up Dominic DiMaggio and Phil Rizzuto from the Philippines, and they assembled a team at the Fort Island Naval Base, at the submarine base at Pearl Harbor, because they had facilities there. They had a barge that was anchored in the harbor that the submarine base team used as their quarters, and they had a baseball diamond there, so they assembled about 30 players under direction of Bill Dickey, who was a lieutenant, and Mace Brown, who was an assistant, and Lieutenant Jack White. These three officers ran the squad, but Bill Dickey was the manager, so they assembled a pretty strong team. And we worked out there for a week and a half, 2 weeks before the Army-Navy World Series took place. And they did play that series at Pearl Harbor, and Admiral Nimitz threw out the first ball at Furlong Field, and the Navy, the way it turned out, I think the Navy won 10 out of 11 or 13 games that we played on the different islands. And then at the end of this particular World Series, then someone got the idea that it would be, meritorious to take an Army team and a Navy team and take them to the forward bases. Guam was just about secured at that time, and possibly Saipan and Tinian, and entertain the troops in the forward areas. Well, this is how that started, Kim.
What were the conditions like in the islands? Mickey Vernon told me that the CBs had just bulldozed areas of the island.
Well, this is after we got down there on that trip. The way that the trip started, there were two plane loads. What had happened was the Army wouldn't give their men permission to go on such a trip, so the Navy got two teams together, and we left on two DC-3s from Pearl Harbor. We landed at Johnson Island for one stop. There wasn't a room enough for a baseball diamond there. Then we flew on to Majuro, where we played our first game in the South Pacific. And then we went on to Eniwetok, Saipan, Guam, Peleliu, and all those forward bases. And I think we played about 20 or 25 ball games on those various islands. Now, some of the fields were just about bulldozed and laid out, because most of those islands hadn't been secured much before that. And some of the playing conditions weren't too good, but we couldn't worry about that, because after all, these guys were over there doing a tough job, and they would appreciate any kind of entertainment.
Sure, so I take it then it was just a base every 90 feet, and there's no grass.
Well, in most instances, the ballparks weren't too good, but there was quite a bit of rivalry between these two particular Navy teams. We both travel on individual DC-3s, all our equipment.
So all 30 players were Navy people?
That's right. They're all Navy people, but we had little side bets on each one of the games, so that kind of created the rivalry, and it kind of created a more of a dramatic situation rather than just going through the motions. So there are even cases, I think some of these other fellows will tell you about, that where people were knocked down at the plate. Well, this is hard to believe, because you're traveling together in a group, and here you are knocking people down trying to win ball games. So they played, it was really a blood and guts series against one another. And we had some money side bets on these games that made it a little more interesting. But all in all, we got down there, after we got through playing the games, they stationed us all over the South Pacific. Incidentally, I don't know whether this is true or not, but we didn't realize we were going to leave Pearl Harbor on this trip. And we were staying, after the Army-Navy World Series was completed, we were staying on the barge and still working out what for, we didn't know, because we were waiting for an assignment somewhere in the area to go back to our original assignment. And finally, one day, Bill Dickey, we had a workout at Furlong Field, and Bill Dickey called us all in a group around him, And he said, "Man," he said, "we're going down to the forward areas. I guess you've heard about the trip." Well, we had all heard about the trip. But the thing we didn't know about, we weren't coming back. What had happened was Bobby Riggs was on a shortwave radio one night telling about how they're going to take the Navy team down to the forward areas and entertain the troops. And he and Buddy Blatton were going to go along and give tennis exhibitions and ping pong exhibitions. Freddie Apostoli was going along with Georgie Abrams to give boxing exhibitions at night. So it was kind of it was a worked out type of a program for the men down there. But the thing was, it was shortwave to Guam, and by this time, Nimitz's headquarters had been transferred from SINPAC, which is SINPAC at Pearl Harbor, had been transferred to Guam because Guam was secured. And Nimitz didn't know we were coming, so he sent this is the way I heard it. I don't know whether it's a gospel truth or not, but he sent a wire back to Pearl Harbor, and he said, "Okay," he said, "send those athletes down here," he said, "and when they get through with their tour, we'll put them to work with a pick and shovels." So when we got down there, well, after the tour was all over, they did scatter us all over the South Pacific. I was on Guam, and Mickey was on Peleliu, a few more on Saipan.
Vernon told me that all of you got assigned to Guam, Saipan, or Tinian, except Vernon, who went to Ulithi, and Fletcher went to Peleliu. Why were those two fellows kind of separated from the rest?
Well, I think they did it kind of haphazardly. I don't think there was any reason for sending them to those particular areas, but they just needed an athletic specialist at those particular bases. They picked somebody's name out of a hat and sent them there.
Where did you wind up?
Well, I actually wound up, when we first went down there, we all started out of Island Command, which was a Marine base. And we were all assigned from out of there. Now, Mace Brown was in charge of the ball club. He was a lieutenant. He had done some pitching for the Pirates and the Red Sox. And Bill Dickey was supposed to go, but for some reason he didn't go. It caused a lot of hard feeling. But Mace took the ball clubs down, and we assembled there, and we started our tour from there. Well, I was eventually stationed at Command of Marianas, which was in charge of the forward area assignments for all the ships in the South Pacific. And the man who was assigned with me was Bobby Riggs. And the reason that he was assigned with me is because Admiral Hoover, who was in charge of that base, was a great tennis buff, and one of the first things they did when they got out of the island was build two tennis courts. So I was a chief petty officer, and Bobby was a first class.
So you were stationed then up on the hill on Guam.
I was at Command of Marianas, which was an operating area there where they were conducting the all the ships in the area. And later on, when Nimitz was there, it was called SINPAC, was up on top of the hill. This was a different base, see? But anyway, I got stationed there with Bobby, and our assignments were to give exercise every morning at 6 o'clock to the whole camp. There were 440 people in that camp that were service personnel, electricians and machinists and everything else that were required for the maintenance of the base. They had more officers than they did enlisted men. And I used to give exercise at 6 in the morning. Every morning, including Sunday, because the Admiral had a penchant for physical culture, you know.
And, how long did these PT sessions last?
Well, they lasted about a half an hour, and I had to lead the exercises. And Riggs didn't care too much to do the exercise, so I said, "Look, I'll give the exercises, Bob. You just go back in the back line and get out of sight," because you should have seen him as a sailor.
He was a sailor.
Oh, yeah. Riggs. He was a seaman. I think he was a first-class athletic specialist. He had duck feet. And he had this hat sitting on top of his. He looked like one of our gang comedy. That's what he looked like. But he was a con man. So I said to him, "Look, Bob," I had a Quonset hut where I kept all the athletic gear. And I said, "Look, Bob, you get down there. There's a shack down by the two courts. Get down and keep the Admiral happy. Make sure he has enough tennis balls and rackets and that the officers are happy." And I said, "That's your job. Just let me take care of the rest." But I got two seamen and worked on the courts and everything, the baseball and basketball, whatever we had to make. That's what I had to do there. Now. It wasn't that tough.
Well, let me ask you this. I realize this doesn't pertain exactly to the tour, but I still don't understand how you fellas were made instant chiefs. So is that just something?
Well, we weren't made instant chiefs. What had happened? No, what had happened was most of the Navy bases, the big Navy bases in the States, like Great Lakes and Bainbridge, and like Lambert Field, they had baseball teams as part of their programs. And most of the fellows who went in at that time, the early part of their enlistment, were seamen first class. But after they completed about 6 or 8 months of or played a baseball season, they sent all of us to Bainbridge, Maryland, where we took about an 8-week course in physical training. That after we come out, we received rating. And when most of us later on came out, the highest rating we could get out of it would be first class. No one was made a chief. And most of us who made chief were made chief overseas. We had to be in the uniform about a year before we got it. So we weren't made instantly. Although the early part of the program, the people who did go into that program, like Freddie Hutchison and people like that,
Bob Feller,
they were the first group that went in the Tunney program. They were given chief's ratings, I guess more or less to attract them, so that their names would attract other enlistees into that program. That's how they got the chief ratings.
How were you received by the Navy men on the island?
Very well. They turned out in droves. We played, everywhere we played, they turned out.
Can you give me an estimate of how many people watched?
Well, we played on Saipan, and we played in sort of a crater. And the Marines were prevalent over there because the Marines and the Seabees were on land, and the Navy was on the water. And they didn't get too many Navy men at these games. But we got I think it was on Tinian that we played a game in a sort of a crater. And we had to hold the game up for an hour and a half because some of our guys had gone off on a B-29 flight just to see what a B-29 was. They were invited to fly on a B-29. They had to hold the game up for an hour. We had 15,000 people ringing the hills there. It was like a natural bowl. So we had about 15,000 people from all over the island. They came. We just zeroed in on it. And then some of the other places, we'd have 5,000-6,000 people. But those Army and Navy World Series in Pearl Harbor, it only seated 5,000 people. Well, the Seabees were ingenious, you know. They built a big pile of dirt. I never seen anything big. They got together 3 or 4 days before the ball game, and they just built a big pile of dirt. But this was for the Seabees only. They were the only ones who were allowed on it was the Seabees. They had a grandstand, an upper deck seat looking down on a ball game.
Kind of like earthworks.
Earthworks. They just piled a lot of earth together, and there weren't any seats. If you had to sit on the side of the hill, that's what they did. You know how the Seabees are. They were tricky. They were the ones that built a lot of the ball fields over there. They had all the equipment.
So. Did you have trouble slipping on coral? I'm sure there were bits and pieces.
No, they covered it over with soil. There wasn't any too much coral. The roads were all coral, most of those places over there. We didn't have any trouble.
Of course, I realize a lot of those islands are pretty cut up because of pre-invasion shelling.
Yeah. Well, one of the fields we played on Eniwetok, that hadn't been secured. That's all coral. It was kind of a rough field where there was high grass in the outfield and stuff, but that didn't, we didn't complain about that because after all, it was just...
How did you choose which 15 were on one team and which 15 were on the other?
Well, I don't know how they did that, to tell you. I don't know how they did that, kid. They try to get so many pitches on one club and so many, they try to balance out with infields and outfields. Just, I guess they just sat down and broke them down in groups because we were all living on a barge for a week and a half, 2 weeks before we played the series. We played in Pearl Harbor, we went to Maui, we went to Kauai, we went to all the other islands and played over there, but against the Army team. So we were together for a month and a half, all these guys, and most of us had known one another through playing baseball. But it was a wild bunch. You know, you just put those things together.
Do you have any impressions of the islands themselves? Do you have any experiences which may not pertain to baseball on the islands?
Your life was fairly commonplace on outside of Pearl Harbor. Now, Pearl Harbor was more of it was overcrowded, so it wasn't a thrill to go downtown or do anything else. You might go out to dinner once in a while downtown, but there wasn't that much to do. If you liked to go swimming, you went to the beaches. There was enough to do, and with playing a baseball program, you were pretty busy. And some of us, I played on the basketball club at IEA. They had a basketball team too, that a league during the winter. It was summer for me at basketball, and winter in basketball. Baseball and basketball just almost intertwined. Then they had football teams over there too, so you could watch them during the fall. So they had a complete athletic. Then they had boxing. It was a complete, athletic program that they had for those people.
Were you restricted as to where you could travel on the islands at that time, since they had just been secured, or did you go boogie stomping?
You could, if you went in Honolulu, you had to get overnight passes. They check you on that. Now, if you want, you were on Guam, certain areas were restricted because there were a lot of Japs floating around the boondocks. You want to go on the other side of the island and get a pass. And we used to do that once in a while when I was on Guam because the chiefs that I was living with, some of the chiefs, used to go over there and dig for shells in the water on the other side of the island where there were quite a few of them over there. And we used to go over there and do a little underwater with just the glass, not the snorkels, and dig them out. This guy used to make these seashell necklaces and stuff like that and sell them for $25 a set. And we used to just go over there and maybe pick a stalk of bananas out of the boondocks. But you had to be careful over there because there was some Japs holed up over on that side. And that's why they had to get a special pass to go over. But we'd go over with a weapons carry, and a couple of guys would carry carbines and stuff like that along with them. But you had to be cleared.
How did the Chamorros treat
the Navy Corps? They worked for most of on a Navy basis. They were very gentle people. Yeah, very gentle people, you know, very nice and easy to get along with. I felt sorry for most of them. The living conditions were not too good, and some of them had these leg sores and everything else, but they're fairly well civilized over in Guam anyway.
Sure.
And then most of the other islands, we didn't get to see too many of them.
Any other impressions that you can think of? Anything we haven't touched on?
Well, it just amazed me that the DC-3 could carry so much equipment. You know, you take 15 guys and all their equipment. A couple of times that thing didn't look like it was going to get off the ground. When we're going down the runway, you know, we just hold your breath. And a couple of places over there, Pee-wee, because he was adventurous. So we got the Peleliu, and they got mixed up with a bunch of Marine flyers. And they took them off in these fighter planes, and the only way you could sit in the fighter plane, they had to sit in the guy's lap, and the other guy was running. This guy was running the plane. They made a couple of runs on Yap and Bobblesop over there. They really took some runs over there, and they got naturally everywhere they went. Everywhere we went, we couldn't go to the officers' club. So the highest ranking people we had were chiefs,
except for Brown.
But he was a lieutenant, and the rest of us were chiefs in first class.
Brown hang around with you?
Oh, yeah. He was with us most of the time. He didn't have any more control over us than the man on the moon.
That's amazing. We used
to salute him like this, you know. He'd say, come on, fellas. But he was a hell of a guy. He was a perfect guy for the job because it was pretty hard restraining.
Did he hang loose?
Oh, he was great. He handled perfect. Around Connie Ryan and L.B. Fletcher and Bob Klinger. Bob was a pitcher for the Pirates and the Braves, and L.B. was quite a first baseman, and Connie was a pretty good infield. In fact, he's a coach with the Braves. Well, they're quite a little bit adventurous. Neither one of them were chiefs, but we had khakis over there, so there wasn't any problem getting an overseas, one of those, yeah, those hats, garrison caps, and then they borrowed some bars, see, and they wound up in the officers' clubs. So one night they went over to the motor pool, and they got a Jeep out on the town. This is on Guam. Well, we were living in tents over there at the time. And we had all our eating utensils wrapped around the poles, you know. We were sleeping in cots and with the mosquito netting because there were a lot of mosquitoes over there. Well, I was in this tent with Connie. About 2:30 in the morning, I hear this rattling in the pole. And here's Klinger and Ryan carrying, Klinger and Fletcher carrying Connie into the hut. And they're knocking those utensils all over the place, you know, trying to get him into his cot and get the screening over. And I got up and put a lamp on, and Christ, he's banished from head to foot. But what had happened, they'd been out to an officer's pub, and on the way back, I don't know who was driving, one of them wasn't Connie. He made a sharp turn, he fell out on a coal road. We're going about 45 miles an hour. He just scraped himself from the tip of his toes to the top of his head. He could hardly walk for about a week. The coral just cuts you like a razor blade. But that's how he got all those cuts. First, I thought he. Well, yeah, I was in the hut on what when that happened. I said, what the hell's the matter with you? He could hardly talk. He was probably half drunk, half bombed, and he was half stunned and half just cut to pieces because Carl will cut you just like a razor blade. And he just fell out of that car going around a corner, and, well, holy Moses, here he comes into that. They took him to a first aid station. They bandaged him all up, and they put him in his bunk and left him there and went to bed.
They discovered?
No. They were well protected. base protected them all. Nobody ever got in any trouble.
Any other interesting stories?
Well, one of the most interesting things is at the end of the war, I was on Guam, and I got enough points to come back. I was a chief and went down to the outgoing unit to get a ship. I ran into Pee Wee Reese. He was down there. He was going back on the same ship that I was going back on. So we got on board the ship the next morning to go back to the States. And we no sooner got on board the ship than one of the ship's officers who was stationed on board the ship got a hold of both of us. And he said, Chiefs, he says, I want one of you chiefs to stand by that hole. And he said, we're going to have a working party. Go down to that hole and bring up these lot of these extra cots and put them up forward someplace. He said to me, you chief, you stand by that hole. And he said to the other chief, you go get a working party. He told Reese to go get a working party and come back, see?
So Reese was a chief, too.
He was a chief. So Pee-wee comes off, he don't come back. We're underway. And hell, Pee-wee don't come back, so I disappear. So about 2 days later, we're at sea, and a guy taps me on the shoulder. So the lieutenant said, hey, chief, where the hell did you go? I says, what do you mean, where'd I go? He said, I thought I told you to stand by that hole. He said, well, the other chief went for the working party. I said, well, he never came back for the working party. I wasn't going to stay there all day. He said, I'm looking for him, too. So Pee-wee used to, every time Pee-wee would see this guy, he'd run up one of the lifeboats, and they had a cover on him. See, these lifeboats, and he'd hide under the cover. He wouldn't let this guy catch him, the lieutenant. But the funniest, the thing that ever happened to two of us coming back, we come back in the USS Cecil. It was an AK attack transport. So they had about 1,200 passengers on board besides the crew. Well, 600 were CBs, 400 were Marines, and 200 were just plain sailors. And these 400 Marines were in all invasions, and the CBs were in a lot of invasions. So we're underway about a day, and we hear a notice come over the loudspeaker. Chiefs Ferrick and Reese lay down to the first lieutenant's office. What the hell's coming off? We thought they wanted us for that job we left. So we get down, and this lieutenant says, Chief, he said, both of you chiefs are athletic specialists. You're the only ones on board. The captain has decided he wants you fellows to give exercise on a fantail every afternoon at 3 o'clock. So I looked at Pee. I said, in the pig's eyes, we're not going to do it. Pee says, I'm not going to do it either. He says, what do you mean you're not going to do it? I said, listen, lieutenant. I says, we're going back to the States. We're going to get out of the service. I said, you can put us in the brig if you want to. I said, we go back there in the afternoon and try to make those guys do exercise, they'll throw us overboard. These guys have been through all kinds of invasions. They don't want to be bothered. He says, you know, you got a point. I said, well, we're not going to do it. I don't care what you do with us, because we don't want to wind up in a drink. Pee-wee says, I'm with you. So the next day afternoon, we get a call to come down again. He says, well, the captain sees your point. He says, what we want you to do, though, is a few pieces of athletic equipment on board the ship. One is a big basketball, and one is a volleyball. I don't know what you can do with it. He says, well, the captain wants you to go back there every afternoon at 3 o'clock and make it on a voluntary basis that the people will do exercise if they want. And if they don't want to do it, you don't have to do it. Just set up the volleyball and give them the basketball. Let them play volleyball on it. Back of the hole, see? There was a cover on the hatch. So we went back there every afternoon at 3 o'clock, and we said, anybody want to do any exercise? Nobody to answer. To ourselves, you know. Nobody answered. We put up the basketball, the net, you know, the volleyball net, put the basketball down, and we'd walk up.
Figuring they could handle it themselves.
We were, but can you imagine a captain wanting two people to do that?
Probably wanted to keep the men fit, but I can see if they.
You should have seen some of those guys. You know, they weren't. Well, they didn't want to get involved in anything. They want to lay on the deck and just sun themselves.
Where was the point of debarking? Treasure Island.
We left from Treasure Island. Some of us, we went over on different kinds of ships. Some of us went over quite a bit ahead of others. I left from Treasure Island in January of 44, I went over on the cruiser Birmingham and went to Pearl Harbor. There's about 15 of us on that ship. The rest of them come over on other types of ships later on.
Now, what was the point of debarkation on the trip back? You say you left from Opera Harbor, Guam, and then where did the ship go?
It came from, it landed in San Pedro, California. It's south of Long Beach. You know, a funny part of it was, too, when Pee-wee and I got on that ship in the harbor in Ganya, I think it was, the ship was just about getting ready to get underway, and here comes a complement of soldiers. Here comes a complement of soldiers, and 35 ball players get on board this ship up these ropes. And it was Walt Judnick and Bertie Tebbets and all those Army ball players. And there's 35 of Bob Dullinger, Ferris Fain, Sid Hudson. Most of them were major leaguers. They had been at the ball club, but they had been finally sent to the forward bases when they were stationed on Guam and Saipan and Tinian. So we had a major league representation on a ship. Buster Mills. And we had quite a few of the 35 were major league ball players and minor league ball players. So they all landed. We all landed at San Pedro, and from there, I think I stayed out there a couple of days. Now I hopped the train and came all the way to the east.
I trust that you guys had a lot of stories to tell from spring training 1946 or the start.
Oh man, that was well. We were all scattered to the seven winds. You know, everybody was on a different ball club. But an interesting sidelight of that trip was. When this thing started to get underway at Pearl Harbor, Schoolboy Rowe had a bad back, so he was supposed to make the trip. So in order to make a replacement for him, they put Del Ennis on the list. And Del at that time was only a minor league ball player, but it turned out to be great exposure for him because it gave us the chance to see what potential that Del had. And I think when we all got back, I think every ball club in the league outside of the Phillies, I mean, there were other players on other clubs. They all had information to give to their people about how great a player this Del Ennis was going to be, because here he was playing against, hitting against people like Vandermeer and Rigney and top-notch major league pitchers, and he more than held his own. He was outstanding. And I think this was great exposure for Del, because I think it wasn't long after that he came to the big leagues and was an established player. Yeah. And he was only a minor league player, but this is the way his opportunity came about to go on this trip. I don't know whether you call it an opportunity or not, but...
I was wondering why he was alone, because I think he had played only class
Well, see, Billy Herman and Billy Herman had some age on him, and Schoolboy had a bad back, so they figured rather than take anybody that was ailing, and Schoolboy wasn't a youngster at that time either, they decided to leave those type of people back and take a younger player who could stand that kind of a rigorous type of a trip, because it had some rigors to it. You know, you sleep in tents and bouncing around on a plane. It wasn't too inviting. I think that's where Del got all his recognition, because when we came back from that trip, everybody recognized the caliber play he was going to be someday, and it turned out to be, you know, true. I think everybody tried to make a deal for him when they got back, you know, all the other clubs, on the basis of what, yeah, the word had gotten back, yeah. Yeah. And another man who made who didn't make the trip was over there pitching in the service at the time. Bob Lemon was the third baseman, and he started pitching in the service. And when he came back from the service and rejoined Cleveland, and about 2 years after he rejoined Cleveland, became one of their outstanding pitchers. He had been a minor leaguer in their farm system, but he got his pitching experience at Pearl Harbor. Yeah.
Anything else?
Well, it's pretty hard to package everything that had happened in a year and a half, 2 years. There's a lot of little incidents that come to my mind right now, but it was a very invigorating type of an experience. If you had to be somewhere, we didn't hear any shots fired or anything else, so we weren't in any trouble. And we did hope to provide some kind of entertainment for those people over there. Think you got it?
But Tom Ferrick told me that one of the reasons you went on the trip was because they decided not to take Schoolboy Rowe and Billy Herman, because Rowe had a bad back and Herman was getting up in years. Do you agree with that?
Yes. That was right. I think that was anyway.
Okay, now how much minor league experience had you had before you went on?
Just 1 year at Trenton.
Was it Interstate League, Class
Interstate.
B?
Interstate. Class B.
I see. And you were playing Navy ball in Honolulu. You were brought in for the Service World Series? Or?
No, I was really brought in for, I was a signalman. I was brought in for the Hawaiian Sea Frontier. And when I went over there, there was a word that I played organized ball, and they were forming this group that was going to tour the islands, and that's how I got into that.
So you weren't one of these physical education specialists. I mean,
no, I was a signalman.
Yeah. What was your rank at the time? Did you advance up the ladder? Or?
Well, I was third class signalman at the time.
I see. Right. Who contacted you about going on the tour? Was it Bill Dickey or?
No. When I got over into Hawaii, as I say, I went over for the Hawaiian Sea Frontier. And when I no sooner got there that it was right, and they were in the progress of order forming this two groups, and they saw that I was on my records that I was from the Phillies. It had happened that I signed with the Phillies before I went overseas, and right away they thought I was a major league player, so they grabbed me. I guess that's what it seemed like anyway. Because I was with the Philly organization, and it had where I was with the Philadelphia Phillies.
Right.
So they probably need another man.
Fine. Farrick and Brancato and Vernon have all told me that there were around 30 people on the tour, and that you just divided up into
two teams,
15
right.
each. Now, how did they decide who went where? Did they just take half the outfielders and put them on one team and half on the other, or did they try to divide it according to league? Or?
That I didn't remember. I think it was National and American League. In other words, they took the National League players and put them on a team and the American League players on a team.
I see. You say you hit several islands. You just want to go through them for me? I know some of them, but I'd like to get a more complete list.
Well, let's what the islands were. Let's see. We hit Johnson to start off with, which was the first stop, which wasn't big enough to play on. Then we went to Majuro.
Majuro
and Aweetok. Palau, Marianas, Guam, Saipan, Tinian.
Did you hit Ponape?
That don't strike a note with me now.